The edited recording you're about to hear is from a Pivot Spokane main stage event that was captured live on January 25th, 2024 at the Washington Cracker Building in downtown Spokane. The theme of the evening was firsts, which can encompass anything from a maiden voyage to a rookie move or beginner's luck. But the stories are all true, and they're all delivered without the benefit of notes. There were six storytellers in total at this event: Tyler Koopman, Brad Hauge, Amy Midstock, Jerry Newell, Michael Schneider, and Mackenzie Woolley. The interstitial music was provided by DJ Normo, and the MC for the evening was James D. Bean Johnston.
We're very fortunate to have this first speaker because his wife is due any minute. I believe that yesterday was the due date, correct? Saturday. So to get you started, we're going to hear our first guest storyteller recount a harrowing event in New York City, complete with homeless people, hookers, and superheroes. Please welcome Tyler Koopman. Come on up, Tyler.
There I was in New York City at 11 p.m. on a Friday night without a bed to sleep in. Didn't know what to do. I had no friends or family in the area. I knew nothing about New York City, what was safe or areas to avoid. And at 20 years old, I could not afford a hotel room in Manhattan. I got into this situation from a good thing. My parents allowed me to have free airline benefits when I was in college. So I would do these spontaneous weekend trips to new cities. It was amazing. But this particular trip, I neglected to book a place to sleep. Somewhat irresponsibly, I still flew out on a Friday, landed in New York, went to a Yankees game. I walked out of the gates at 11, no place to go. I had a flip phone at that time. I called every single hostel in New York, I swear. All of them booked until the next night. So I kind of was weighing my options. I figured the only thing I could do really at that point was just walk around and stay awake all night, get to tomorrow and maybe just find a place to relax. And so I went to Times Square to relax. Sat down on a bench, it was midnight. These lights were so bright, advertisements. I'd close my eyes and it was like nothing even changed. There were loud noises all night, deep into the night. Strange people approached me, I was offered drugs, I was offered sex, and by about 2 a.m., a couple hours in, I had that thin layer of grime you get from a long day in an airport or a big city. I felt gross. I was stressed out, I was frustrated at myself, and don't get me wrong, I really don't mind improvising in life. Going off the script is fun, but this particular trip, I just had really dropped the ball and put myself in this bad situation. So I'm sitting there. My eyes are getting heavy. I'm about to fall asleep. I can't afford to get robbed. So I stand up. I just need to start walking. I go 20, 30, 40 street blocks through Central Park until I come across this intersection that has some cameras being set up. And I was pretty intrigued at what was happening, so I stuck around. And it wasn't long before I realized something bigger was happening. This whole area was transforming, and a one-block barricade was being set up all around me, and I was at the center of it. There was X-marked tape on the ground, like for positioning people, and camera tracks in the street, cargo trailers starting to pull in, and by 4:30 a.m., still not many people around, but two of them were there that looked like they knew what was going on right at the middle of it. So kind of tentatively, I walked up, I asked them what was going on. They were suspicious of me, concerned why I was even there. They turned, said they were filming a movie, and then just sort of brushed me off. So I kind of walked, I gave them a little space. And I thought, man, a movie. I've always wanted to be in a movie. Like, what a fun fact to have, a great bucket list item. So I had two options, really. One, I could make my way out of the barricade and be on with my day, get out of there right away. Two, stick around, pretend like I'm supposed to be there, and just kind of see what happens. So I flash back to the movie Catch Me If You Can, which I love. It's a true story. This kid fakes his way through these crazy situations until getting arrested by the FBI. So in that moment, maybe not the best role model, but it was kind of the motivation I needed from this grueling night. I was feeling a second wind, so I said, okay, here we go. Let's try to get into this movie. So first thing I did, I found this random equipment guy, walked up and asked if I could stick around. He had no stake in me being there, just could not have cared less. And he kind of said, yeah, sure, go ask that guy. He's the set director. So I'm walking, turn towards this guy. As I'm headed towards him, he starts talking to those two people that I had approached earlier. They're all standing there, and simultaneously they turn, look at me, and the two of them point right at me like I'm some sort of criminal. This guy leaves the conversation. He's walking towards me, and we make eye contact. I'm just thinking, what am I going to say? I don't know. He approaches me, and he says, hey, who are you? What are you doing here? How can I help you? I said, well, I just talked to the guy over there, and he said that I needed to come and find you to ask about where I'm supposed to be for the filming. He kind of looked at me and said, I don't understand. Are you background talent, or what do you mean by that? Yeah, I'm background talent. I'm here to be an extra. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Why are you here so early? Doesn't matter. You can't be here right now. You can't be over here. You got to at least go and wait across the street. Wait for everyone else to show up, okay? Okay. I walk over here. I'm waiting on the street corner, and it wasn't more than an hour that passed, and I was surrounded by over 100 people. And this lady is walking through the crowd picking who would get work on the set that day. She maybe picked 20 people and sent the rest of them home. And at this point, too, just for context, these are legitimate actors. People who came dressed in costume with makeup on. We had the homeless guy, the business guy, the fashionable New York person, the tourist, all of them. And I was just there in my shorts, my backpack, and my Yankees hat. She's going through you, picking her vision out. You. She picked me. I couldn't believe it. I take two steps, and then she says, hey, stop. What are you doing? You can't have an Aquafina bottle in your backpack. We can't have brands on the set. You know better than that. Oh, my God. I'm so sorry. Yep. Toss it in my pack. Okay, we're good. I get to this corner that she sent me to. Next thing I know, this Polaroid camera flashes in my face, and this lady is asking for our union numbers. The person on my right says 100. I'm next. At this point, I have no idea the scale of this number system. I don't know if there are thousands of numbers, if 100 is the max, if I'm going to make up a number and it happens to be that guy's. No idea. 101. She kind of looked at me a bit oddly, slowly wrote it down, slowly walked away looking at me. We got through it. We were just getting our placement for this scene, which, by the way, I didn't even know what movie this was. And any movie could have been great for my bucket list goal of being an extra. But sure enough, we're getting our position. I see a commotion over the kind of across the street where I'd started. And out walks this person who I immediately recognize due to the skin-tight outfit, blue and red, webby design. My favorite superhero of all time, Spider-Man. Couldn't believe it. We're in a Spider-Man movie. We get our direction. He has a dialogue scene over there. There's madness in the street, and we're all just supposed to be, wow, what's happening? Like, just looking at the street. The problem is the cameras are over there, and we are over here. And there is no way that they're panning to us. We will not be seen in this movie. So we do about an hour of these takes. I'm just trying my best. We wrap up. Spider-Man goes off to his trailer, and I'm just thinking, man, I don't know if this whole thing's over, but I got to just get over there somehow. Even just if I could see Spider-Man, that'd be really cool. So I ask if I can go to the bathroom, because the building right behind the dialogue scene is where the bathroom was. So here we go. Two layers of security, just, oh, yeah, thanks. Just head to the bathroom. Yep. Yeah, just head to the bathroom. Thank you. Into this building, into the bathroom, look myself in the mirror. Come on, you can do this. I walk back out. Instead of going right, I go left. I climbed under a piece of the set and popped up right in front of the camera. I met this guy next to me named Brad. He was an extra. And then it wasn't a minute later that I feel this firm pat on my back. And I thought, oh, God, someone saw me sneak in. I turn, expecting a security officer. And sure enough, within breathing distance, full Spider-Man garb, mask off, flowing hair, is Andrew Garfield. I for sure peed my pants in a little bit in that moment. I was so, so shocked. I smiled. He was just trying to get through to the front of the group, so kind of let him through. Go ahead. Yeah. So we do another hour of these takes, and I am right in the middle. Like, I have to be in this scene. We do another hour or two of this. It's going great. Finish up. Off Ander goes to his trailer, and I am feeling invincible. Like, is this a career path for me? I'm really wondering. Until I befriended Brad again, who was the other actor, and he asked me a devastating question. He said, "Tyler, what talent agency are you a part of?" And I legitimately did not say anything for like 8 seconds, which is a very long time to just pause. Thank God he saved my ass, and he looked at me and said, "Well, I'm part of Smith Agency." And immediately, of course, "Nice, yeah, Brad, I'm part of Smith Agency too, actually. This is my first movie." Thought I was in the clear, except for he turned and looked at me and immediately was on a dime, turned, and he was pissed. And he looked at me and he said, "God damn it, that's bullshit, man." This really felt over at this point. But he continued. He said, "Man, I've been doing this for years, and I'm just finally getting onto these major film sets like Spider-Man and Smith Agency keeps placing rookie talent out here. I mean, no offense to you. I'm sure you're great at what you do. But it's just bullshit, man, you know?" And I'm just trying not to laugh. I got my hand in my face, and all I could do was agree with him. I said, "Yeah, Brad, I agree, man. This is bullshit right now. This is bullshit." So we got through it. I didn't want to test my luck. I found my way out of the barricade. Great. What an adrenaline rush. The sad reality of my first movie experience, or really any movie experience, is that they take hundreds of hours of film. You never know what's going to be included in the movie or what's going to be cut out. But a year later, I go to the theaters to see The Amazing Spider-Man 2 with some of you in this room. And sure enough, about 21 minutes into the movie, there's this montage scene of Spider-Man saving New York. And right next to Brad, directly behind Andrew Garfield, looking like this all around at what's happening, there I am in my Yankees hat.
All right, so now on to our next, that's a hard act to follow right there, but on to our next speaker. Now, Jerry Newell is our next speaker, and she's going to dazzle you with a story about having to grow up way too young, a couple of good old boys making their way the only way they know how, right? And learning how to have a blast in her 40s. Come on up.
Good evening, everybody. So as far back as I can remember, people always referred to me as acting mature for my age. So as a young child, what that meant was adulting was the goal. So I took that seriously, and by 19, I was married, pregnant, working full-time, and attending college at night. There wasn't a lot of time for fun and games, so I then decided I was going to choose a career in law, of all things. Again, a very serious, responsible career, because there's always something at risk in the law, right? There's children at risk, there's money at risk, property, maybe even someone's freedom. And by the time I graduated from law school, my oldest was 11 years old. And the only question he had for me was, "Mom, where are you going to go to school next?" And I also learned that early on that someone's always upset with you when you practice law. Sometimes it's your client, and sometimes it's the other side. So in my first case, I was hired to find and locate a stolen vehicle. And this wasn't just any vehicle. It was the General Lee. It had been built for the final episode of The Dukes of Hazzard. So, you know, it had a little bit of value. For 2 years, I chased that vehicle all over the United States. And it got to the point where I really wasn't sure we were ever going to get the vehicle back. So one August Saturday morning, I got a telephone call from the Tennessee Highway Patrol. And he said to me, he said, "Ma'am, we've just seized your vehicle at Duke's Fest at the Tennessee Motor Speedway. What would you like us to do with that?" And trust me, his accent was far better. But I had my client on a plane that night, and the next day he was getting a police escort out of Tennessee with the vehicle. It was exciting for a young lawyer to have such a great win. The Spokesman Review came out. They did an article, took my picture hanging out of the General Lee, Daisy Duke style. It was very exciting at the time, until about a week later, when I got a telephone call from my client who said, you know, you might want to take a look at this website. There was my photo from the newspaper, and the website basically suggested that I would perform sexual acts in order to get my order signed. I was mortified. Now, this is before social media, in the early stages of the internet. I fully believed everybody in the world was on the World Wide Web and was going to see this. But that's not what happened. Instead, the career went on, and it continued to be adversarial and suck the life out of me. Then, something started to boil up inside, this secret desire that I had. And at the age of 46, I decided to take all of my now adult children to New York for Christmas. I didn't tell them in advance, but when we got there, I said, by the way, I'm going to take a stand-up comedy class, and you're going to watch me perform at the Gotham Comedy Club at the end of the week. This was far beyond my comfort zone and completely uncharacteristic. To say my kids were surprised is an understatement. When I walked into the American Comedy Institute, which was a 15 by 15 office that looked much like a law office, except for the three rows of folding chairs and the microphone stand and the what was a fake curtain as a backdrop, you wouldn't otherwise know that it wasn't a law office. So for the next week, we spent time in writing sessions with Steven Rosenfield, who is the owner and taught the likes of Jim Gaffigan, among many other comedians through the years. So I was very intimidated. We even spent one whole night with the microphone stand, walking up to the microphone stand, taking the microphone out of the stand, putting the microphone back in the stand. But the very important part is moving the stand away from you. You'd be surprised how difficult that is, especially when you're nervous. So we spent some time in writing sessions with Steven, and I learned that writing comedy is really much like legal writing, because you're just taking your facts, persuasively twisting them to your benefit. In comedy, you want to laugh, right? In the law, you want some ruling in your favor. But I started to talk myself out of doing the performance because I thought, oh, I've really learned a lot. I don't need to really go up there, because I was terrified. So I talked to myself and said, you know, you came all the way to New York. You brought your kids here. Do you really want to give up now? So that desire to actually do the performance really did outweigh the desire to quit. But the night of the performance at the Gotham Comedy Club, my heart was racing. My mouth was so dry. I only had 3 minutes to perform, but I really wasn't sure I could do it. So when they heard my name called and I walked up onto the stage, I made the decision to just leave the microphone right where it was at in the stand. I did not need to have that fight. And I looked out at everyone in the audience, and I could see nothing. Much like tonight, I can see that there's people here, but I cannot make anything out, and that is what I didn't expect. But then I heard my voice, and as I was talking, eventually, I heard laughter. And when I heard that laughter, it was like a bolt of adrenaline, exhilaration that shot through me, and I was hooked. And I realized this was something I needed to do. So I did my set, and I got off and went to the bar, ordered a glass of champagne, and I thought to myself, you know, all of these difficult times in life and all of these humiliating things that happen to us actually make for some pretty good comedy. In fact, my time with the General Lee has turned out to be one of my best jokes. So if I may, so I practiced law for 20 years. It's okay. I've been in recovery now for 5. I've been in recovery from things like this. Once, my photo appeared on a website entitled How to Steal a Car. It said, hire the basket-weaving, lesbian looks of Jerry Newell, who will suck the cock of the judge to get her order signed. I know, it's wild. What self-respecting lesbian would do that? Thank you.
It's getting a little racy in here. Woo! All right, well, I would like you to give a warm Spokane welcome to our next guest, who's going to talk about growing pains of parenthood and unconditional love. Please welcome Amy Midstock.
Before I start, I have one disclaimer. I have the blessing of my child to tell this story. It starts on a June day. I'm driving down the highway in my Subaru, and from the back seat of my car, there's a gaggle of teenagers making noise, TikTok songs on phones, and conversations I'm mostly pretending not to listen to. And then from the back seat, I hear my daughter's voice say, Dad sure is going to be surprised to have 3 sons now. There was brief eye contact in the rearview mirror. And then she slapped a he-they button on his their shirt and joined the patriarchy. Now, I wasn't too worried about this flippant gender flip at first because I'd like to consider myself a progressive and I can roll with anything. And there was a while there, a brief phase, where my kid was really into anorexic dolls and My Little Pony, and that didn't last. Well, it lasted long enough to wreck our karma with non-recyclable plastics. But then it ended. And so I didn't take it too seriously until a few months later when she brought up another conversation in the car about 4 blocks from school. I have learned that important conversations with adolescents often take place in a car, either because they know they're going to get out in a minute or you don't think they're going to jump. I have, on at least one occasion, tried to exit my own mother's moving vehicle, so I don't recommend trusting that your kid doesn't have the courage for that. And it makes for condensed and concentrated conversations in the car. So early morning before school, I've got coffee in one hand, steering wheel in the other, and my kid is talking at me. I'm looking at glaring tail lights. I'm not awake yet. And she looks at me and she says, hey, Mom, nonchalant like, when you were pregnant with me and you didn't know what you were having, what boy names did you have picked out? None, I said. We wanted a girl, and that's what we got. Oh, she said. And this marked the beginning of a long quiet in which there was no space for this iteration of my child. Now, I come from a long line of feminists. My own grandmother, Beverly, after whom my child was named, instilled in me a sense of feminism and superiority, and it was tainted with red lipstick and Avon perfume. She had a sign on her fridge. It said, women can do everything, and men can do the rest. Go, Granny. My female lineage fought abuse and discrimination for generations, sometimes with daytime margaritas and tax evasion, but also with legislation and glass ceiling smashing. Every single one of them who preceded me laid the foundation so that I could be an independent woman, that I could give birth to my own glorious daughter and teach her the ways. It never occurred to me to ask if that's what Bea wanted. In a slow and almost imperceptible shift, my child began to disappear. It started in her avoiding long conversations at the dinner table. And then she just stopped coming to dinner. She made a nest out of her bedroom, turned it into a cozy hideaway, and filled it with mind-numbing distractions. She cried and cried and cried, often alone and misunderstood. And for nearly a year, all she did was watch reruns of The Office, and it became our only common language, the only thing that we still shared. And then we started to lose that, too. It felt like my child was dying, and if she could have talked and we could have listened, maybe that's what she would have said. In time, as the months wore on, a darkness and a heavy weight settled on our home and infiltrated our walls. Something ominous and more violent was creeping in there, spreading across the pale skin of my child. Behind her queer-flagged door, there was a dangerous alchemy happening. It was noted in the violent, gory art that she drew, and in the secret visions of slicing arteries open with broken glass. It was the latter that shattered the cage open. The revelation of it, at least. Months later, tears and anguish and the fear of a mother's loss later, psychiatrists, counselors, doctors, recommended medications later, there is a suicide safety plan on our fridge, at my desk, in the hands of close friends. I'm listening, baby. I'm listening. Just tell me where it hurts. Show me. I believe you. I believe you. I don't want to reduce the journey of adolescent self-discovery and all its horrors to this one aspect of my child. That wouldn't be fair, and it's not my story to tell. My experience, though, is potentially equally as complicated. And it can't be reduced to some sort of simple cliche statement like, well, I lost a daughter, but I gained a son, because neither of those things really feel true for me. What happened was unexpected. I grieved, and I grieved hard, like somebody had died. My family was like, it's not like somebody died. Well, that's not my experience right now. I cried in a strange reversal of roles on my child's shoulders. And she was still there. That's not what everybody can say. I cried for how long I had misunderstood his suffering. And then I cried for the wedding dress that I don't get to buy, although I'm told I can buy a suit. I cried and mourned all of my gender normative ideas, and they were not few, despite how progressive I think I am, about how I would relate to my child, mommy and me pedicures, and how my child would relate to the world. And perhaps most strange, I was faced with this bizarre sense of rejection of my own identity as a woman. Had I failed so miserably at demonstrating the greatness of this, from reproductive rights to menstruation and tax on hygiene products and equal pay or lack thereof and domestic violence, that my kid just decided to defect to the other side, it would be understandable. But I don't think that's what happened. My experience, instead, was a slow clipping of the invisible marionette strings that we all inevitably tug on when we're raising our children, in particular when it comes to gender. What I lost was the expectation that my kid is some kind of extension of me and my own identity. And what I gained was the freedom to step back and watch this human being unfurl and unfold into true self, or at least this version of it. Because as Walt Whitman would say, he contains multitudes, and it is evident in every awesome wardrobe choice. My child, Ben, the turncoat and traitor, wears a bright shirt with a unicorn and a rainbow and the words alpha male. There's lace-edged socks and crop tops and a mohawk and mascara. But most importantly, He seems to embody the things that we all want our children to embody, the values we hope that they carry on. He's loyal and loving, brilliant, funny, an artist, a musician. He embodies the values of authenticity, of self, of truth, of voice, health, and happiness. And he belongs to a gender blending and bending revolution to which we all need to learn the language. And I suspect it has less to do with our concern about grammar and pronouns than it has to do with acceptance and love. And that is also a language I am still learning. Thank you.
Any Brads in the house? How many Brads are in the house right now? Raise your hand if you're a Brad, okay? I'm just going to be honest. I have not always had good luck with Brads. And that's I'm not trying to offend anyone, but I got to tell you, this particular Brad is really cool. I like this guy. I met him at rehearsal, and I'm digging him. So anyway, please welcome him as he comes up and relives his rebellious teenage years for you. Brad Haughey.
Compared to my siblings, I am an extremely rebellious person. Compared to the rest of America's youth, I am a goody two-shoes. But one Friday night, four of my buddies and I decided to put that reality to the test. It was the late 90s. We were bored on a Friday night, but we were pretty good kids. I was a pretty good kid, but we had the influence of movies like Ace Ventura and Tommy Boy and Billy Madison going through our minds at the time. And in Billy Madison, there's this great, just cinematic masterpiece of a moment where they take dog poop, put it into a paper lunch sack, put it on their enemy's doorstep, light it on fire, run away, hide behind a bush, and laugh as the guy comes out and stomps it, and then gets dog all over everywhere trying to put out the fire. So as a bunch of bored 17-year-olds, we go, we should do that tonight. So we do. We go in my buddy's backyard, we fill a bag full of dog poop, and we think, who should we like put this on their doorstep? And we think, oh, I know, our friend David. Now, for the purposes of the story, we're gonna call him David, because his name was David. But for some reason, we chose our friend. And so we go, and we actually go through it. And I'm up there, and I light the bag on fire. There's five of us total. And we run across the street. And as soon as I start leaving the doorstep, I realize, what have I done? My brain goes immediately to, there's nobody home. The bag is going to light into a huge fire. It's going to catch the house on fire. Everyone's going to be in there. In fact, maybe they are home and they were just downstairs and they didn't hear the knock on the door and they're all going to die. And so we left before we saw what happened. But just that tiny bit of rebellion felt like kind of good to us. So we're like, what's the next step? Oh yeah, egging houses. That's the thing people do. So we're like, all right, we go. We go to the Super One up on the South Hill, and we buy one of those, like, I don't even know if they sell them anymore, a gigantic pallet of eggs that no one has any business buying unless you're the fry cook at Frank's Diner. Like, we're talking so many eggs. But again, we're good kids, and we're wusses. So we just pull into some random neighborhood, and we're like, whose house are we going to throw eggs at? We don't know. So we just, like, pick one that's way down the street, and we just start lobbing eggs. And I'm guarantee you 90% of them don't even hit the house. They just like hit the street, maybe land in the front yard. And we just go through this whole pallet just randomly. Like, we don't want to get caught. Our fear of getting caught far outweighs our like rebellious, we're trying to do any damage. But we're still feeling pretty good about ourselves. We're out there, we're living life. We're being rebellious. We're like doing what we need to do to have a good night. So we go through, I don't know, 48, 62, whatever, however many eggs it was. With, again, zero, like, evidence that we did any damage to anything. So we get back in the car, and we're like, what next? And we're like, I don't know, that's probably good. Let's go play some Nintendo 64 and call it a night. So that's what we do. So we're driving, my buddy John is driving, and we're driving, like, back to his house. And we pull around this corner, and one of my friends in our little car, like a little like 89 Honda Accord, goes, "Hey, look," points over to this house. And we see this girl climbing out of her bedroom window, hanging like a few feet above, like dropping out. And this isn't just any girl, this is Courtney. Courtney's real cute. We all knew who Courtney was. So she drops down, and we're like, dude, she's sneaking out of our house. So my buddy lays on the horn. We roll the windows down. We're like, Courtney, busted! And she does what any like 15-year-old girl sneaking out of her house would do. She turns to our car and gives us the double bird. And we think in that moment, how dare she? She has offended us. She has affronted us. So we think, she deserves what's about to happen. So we have no idea where Courtney went. She probably snuck off with someone. But we think we're going to go and get some more eggs and get her back for the punishment that she just gave us by flipping us off. So we go to the local Zip Trip. A couple of my buddies get out of the car. They go into the Zip Trip. They're just in there a couple minutes. They come back, 2 dozen eggs. They're like, yeah, that's fine. But by this time, we are such seasoned vets at rebellion and vandalism. We are feeling so good about ourselves. So we pull back in front of Courtney's house, and we just leave the car running. We open the doors. We're not afraid anymore. We're not f***ing these like 50 yards away at random houses. We have our target, and we are doing target practice. We're like daring each other, like, hit the upper left window, and like we all go for that. They're like, hit the like over here, and we all go for that. And we're just laughing and having a good time. And then all of a sudden, we see that her dad and her older brother, who was a star linebacker at Ferris High School, are sprinting at us as fast as they can with an equal mix of anger, determination, and glee in their eyes. And we just like say a bunch of four-letter words, and we hop in the car and we slam the door closed. And they are so close, they like are pounding on the door, they're like pounding on the windows, and we squeal away and we get out of there, and we're like up two blocks away, and we're like, oh my gosh, like the adrenaline is going, everything's going, but we're safe, we're good, we got away. And then John, who's driving, and again we'll call him John because his name is John, he says one of those four-letter words, and he goes, they're coming after us. And we're like, what do you mean? He's like, they're both coming after us. The dad and the older senior linebacker got in separate cars and started peeling after us through the neighborhood. Now, this part I'm not super, I've been proud of everything up until this point. This part I'm not, we say go, and we are tearing through the neighborhood. You might be like, oh, you thought you were going fast. You were probably just going like 30, 35. I kid you not, we lost 2 hubcaps that night driving around the neighborhood. We're taking corners this way. We're taking corners that way. We're going like all the way on the other side of this, like the neighborhood. We even do that thing twice because there's a lot of cul-de-sacs in this neighborhood. And one time we took a wrong turn to a cul-de-sac. We're like, oh no, what do we do? And we're like, I go, pull into that driveway, turn off the lights and everyone duck. Again, I am not being hyperbolic. We do that, we duck down, the 2 cars swoop the cul-de-sac, and they just think that we're a random car parked in the driveway for the night, and they swoop back out. Eventually, we're like, I don't think they're chasing us anymore. So we all go back to my buddy's house. I don't think we say a word to each other at this point. We get back into our respective cars, and we go home. And again, I was a good kid. I was so afraid of like getting in trouble. I was at my dad's house that weekend. I remember going up, my bedroom was on the 2nd floor. I remember like closing the blinds, and like for an hour, I just like peeked. Like, any cop cars coming? Finally, I realized I was probably good to go. Went to bed, honestly, for the next 3, 4, 5 days, no repercussions. Most of my other buddies went to Ferris. I went to Lewis and Clark. Didn't really hear a thing about it. Then one day, I'm sleeping, it's early in the morning, maybe 6, 6:30, and there's a knock on my bedroom door, and my mom knocks on my door, and she goes, hey, Seth's on the phone. I'm like, that's weird, Seth's on the phone. So I get up all groggy, and I go, hello? And then he says 3 words I'll never forget. He just says, dude, we're busted, and click. He hangs up on me. But I'm not going to say a word to anyone about this. I'm not going to, like, if my mom was like, why did Seth call? I'd be like, oh, he needed help with math. I don't know. Again, I don't tell a soul about our high-speed chase. So again, the next 4 or 5 days, I don't hear a thing. I'm like, actually, we're probably fine. Maybe Seth got busted, and I'm in the clear. Until one night, probably a Friday night, I remember we had a baseball game. I played baseball, got home, I hung out with my girlfriend, and I made it home by curfew, like I always do, because I'm a good kid. Open the garage door, opens, and I see that little, like, sliver of light underneath the door. And I'm like, that light's never on. And I immediately know, dude, I'm busted. And I open the door, and my mom is sitting on the couch in her bathrobe. She's not watching TV, she's not reading, she's just waiting for me. So somehow word got back to her. And by somehow, I mean this. Turns out that Courtney's dad, the recipient of the egg barrage, had some detective skills, because it turned out he was a detective. A few days after the incident, I think he was just driving home, and he found some egg cartons on the side of the road near his home. He thought, He's pulled over, got the egg cartons, looked at them, and saw the Zip Trip sticker on the egg cartons and thought, He went to the local Zip Trip and said, hey, I'm Detective So-and-so. Do you mind if I see the security camera footage from Friday, May 12th, between 11 and 12? And they're like, sure. Sure enough, he sees two like 16-year-old jackasses buying eggs at 11:30 at night. My buddy Seth and my buddy Josh. He has those pictures printed and proceeds to go around to all the local high schools and hangouts, talking to staff, vice principals, counselors, and being like, do you recognize these boys? Do you recognize these boys? Turns out, someone recognized those boys. And it was Seth that was recognized of the dude we're busted. So we were busted. For, I guess now that I'm a 43-year-old mature man of integrity, I realize it was probably fair, but at the time, it was the most unfair thing in the world that they wanted us to pay them to have their house and one of the cars repainted, at least the front of the house. Apparently, eggs do a lot of damage. Things you learn. So my mother, being a woman of integrity, said that I would be doing my fifth of the cost. There were five of us. And not only that, but I was then required to go up to the door and hand them the check and apologize. So, like, I still remember the, like, short drive walk by, I think I might have rode my bike over there, and just, like, trembling as I walk up to the door, and I knock on the door, and I'm saying, hey, I'm Brad, I'm really sorry, here's a check. And he was so nice, and he was understanding, and he just goes, Brad, you're a good kid.
Did I tell you that's a Brad you can just really embrace? The guy is such a nice guy, he wouldn't even imitate Courtney giving him the double birdie. You notice that? His mom's in the crowd. I love you, man. That is awesome. All right, so with that, I would like to introduce our next storyteller. Please welcome him as he conveys his passion for teaching the arts. Michael Snyder, come on up.
My story's 3 or 4 decades old. It's the only kind I can remember. I'm going to take you to Rochester, New York in the mid-80s. There's an older brick school building, used to be a grade school. It's been converted now into Rochester's new magnet school for the arts. We walk in, it's not locked. We stroll down the hall, there's a classroom door open, and we listen in. There's a circle of desks and 10 or 15, 20 maybe, kids, ninth grade through 12th, sitting around, reading out loud David Mamet's American Buffalo, including all the F-bombs. That's a little unusual in the era of Reagan. So The passing bell rings, and we go out in the hall, and the hall fills with kids, age 11 through 18, and two boys approaching each other drop their book bags. One of them slams the other into the lockers. They proceed to beat the hell out of each other for about 15 seconds. Then they calmly pick up their book bags and walk to class. Nobody got hurt. Those guys had skills. So on the way out, we stop, and there's this little black box theater that's been converted from a grade school half gym. And on the door, there's a playbill advertising an upcoming production of The Visit by Friedrich Dürrenmatt in a high school. Are they kidding? We know the story. The richest woman in the world returns to her hometown and explains to them that the reason they're all destitute and on the dole is because she bought their pencil factory and shut it down. She says she'll open it again. She'll make them all rich. If and only if they kill the guy who is now the leading contender for mayor. Her teenage lover who knocked her up got two of his friends to testify that they'd slept with her too, forcing her to leave town in disgrace and sell sex to stay alive. She's still alive. And she's back. She's like a one-woman Me Too movement. Anyway, the then mayor, the incumbent mayor, summons all of his dignity and says, "Oh, no, 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 no. This is Europe. We're civilized. This is not the jungle. We could never do that." But they all start buying luxury goods on credit at her former boyfriend's store. And at the end, after a scene that's a cross between a call and response church service and a Nazi rally, the town's wrestling champ strangles him. Just look it up. It's not as grim as it sounds. There are plenty of good laughs in the second act if you know how to pull them out. Anyway, I didn't make any of that up. All that stuff. That all happened in that school. It was a different time. We weren't, we didn't have to deal with legions of book banning barbarians struggling to be seen strutting on the moral high ground and putting teachers under a microscope. I had total freedom in what I chose for my students to read in my lit classes and in what we chose to put on stage until 1992. That's the year we decided, my students and I, to create our own show and based loosely on the social circus surrounding the case of a serial killer. Not a hypothetical serial killer, a real one, from Rochester. A guy had been seen riding his bike near the school and talking up the cops at the donut shop down the street. You can imagine there was immediate righteous pushback, lots of it. Little meetings that I wasn't privy to. But then I was summoned to a full staff meeting to defend the project. So I took it seriously. It was a hopeless cause, but I took it seriously. I stood on a tabletop. That was 32 years ago. I was a little more spry. I explained to them that what we were doing was akin to Saturday Night Live's treatment of the OJ trial, only ours would be funnier and have more bite. I explained that we were not trivializing serial murder. We were targeting those who did trivialize it by exploiting it for profit. The local TV anchors who put on their gravitas faces and led with it whenever they could before turning to lighter topics and laughing at their own unfunny banter. That show's still playing 7 nights a week all across the country. A sheriff who gloried in the limelight, loved publicity, who used the whole thing to further embellish the myth of himself. I know that's kind of inaccessible to you, but that's what we did. We were exposing a parole system that placed this guy in Rochester without really telling anybody who he was. He was a killer with the conscience of a shark. We went after the professional forensic witness industry, in particular, a guy who gathered big bucks all over the country for his reliability in testifying that a defendant couldn't plead insanity because he wasn't a psychopath, merely a sociopath. We were lampooning a judge and prosecutor who shamelessly exploited the thing to boost their careers. I stressed that we had no interest whatsoever in the killer himself. We gave him a name, Bobby Blight, but beyond that, he was merely he wasn't even human. He was a walking stage prop that looked like a fat, bald, ugly, middle-aged man even when he was in the seventh grade. And he was gonna have no lines. If you think that speech might have mollified the opposition, you're dumber than I was. Anyway, the opposition continued, but it turned to obstruction. When I wanted to get into the building to build set on the weekends, suddenly there was a new rule. I couldn't be in the building with students unless there was an administrator present. Shucks, there just wasn't anybody who wanted to do that. This was after a decade of late rehearsals when my students and I were the last people to leave the building, but can't fight that. There was some more insidious, nasty pushback. Students being cornered and being told that they were involved in something bad, immoral, that they were going to embarrass themselves and bring disgrace to the school. And they added, who does Schneider think he is? That he thinks he can write a play. Actually, we weren't presuming to write a play. My students and I were pretty sure we could string together a set of sketches, hold an audience for an hour and a half, tell a story, keep them laughing, and give them something to think about afterwards. Is it going to be a play? We didn't care. Would it get the stamp of approval from Aristotle? That was the least of our concerns. The pushback didn't work. Even there wasn't a single student, not one, who left the project. They knew what we were doing. They understood it. They were having a lot of fun, improvising, creating characters, creating storylines. So we kept going. 3 weeks before opening, a student and I began writing. She wrote 3 scenes in the first act and punched up a bunch of my stuff. At one point, I was up in my office writing the trial scene and sending the pages down one at a time while they on the stage were blocking and memorizing them. That's how good those kids were. So, opening night, March 7th, 1992, nearly a full house. We look around. There aren't any administrators here. They're flouting their own rule. I don't confront people. I never asked why, but I think they were assuming it was going to be a disaster. People were going to walk out in droves and blame them on the way, and that they'd be able to shut us down on day two. Maybe they were thinking they could get rid of me too, you know, or force me to do the Sound of Music as penance. I don't know. Anyway, the show had to go on, so house lights down, stage lights up, the radio's on, Patti Page is singing, tra-la-la, diddly-ay-day, it gives me a thrill to wake up in the morning to the mockingbird's trill. Meanwhile, on stage, Mrs. Blight, Bobby's mother, is trying to fish some pickles out of a jar with a pair of scissors. There's a dog howling and screaming off stage. She goes over and she says, Bobby, get that dog off the barbecue. And she goes back to the pickles. There's a knock on the door, and Mrs. Gooey, the grade school counselor, is there. She's brought in an iron pipe that Bobby used to attack the other children on the school bus. Mrs. Blight grabs the iron bar, hurls it into the wings with a lot of clatter, breaks down sobbing about how those children on the bus pick on her boy. And of course, Mrs. Gooey is very sympathetic. She soothes her, and by the end of the scene, they're both happily looking forward to bingo night at church. And the scene change is covered by Bing Crosby singing, I love those dear hearts and gentle people who live in my hometown, because those dear hearts and gentle people will never, ever let you down. Nobody here remembers that, right? Okay. Anyway, I'm not going to tell you, I'm not going to recount the whole play. I'd hate that, and so would you. There were some unique bits that we did. There was a plea bargaining scene that was written entirely in rhymes. There was a set of parole board hearings staged as musical chairs. And weirdest of all, there was a sort of dress parade for jurors. They'd come downstage and pose while two local TV celebrities in evening gowns told us about them. How they had that one special quality you need in a high-profile case, people who were intelligent but uninformed. Anyway, the play ended. It was I just called it a play. I shouldn't have called it a play. It ended with Bobby convicted of murdering 37 fishermen in the Genesee River Gorge. The judge is about to pronounce sentence, but there's a camera crew up there, and she has to wait for them because they're shooting a political ad for her. They give her a cue, and she solemnly, magisterially intones, Mr. Blight, you have held center stage in this community for far too long. That's the cue for the curtain call, the whole cast coming on stage, doing the hokey pokey and turning themselves around. That's the play. Nobody walked out. It garnered more catch you by surprise, legitimate laughs per minute than any show that school had ever done. And those brave, smart kids who did that are now near 50. But I think if you asked them if they were harmed in any way, morally, emotionally, socially, by that experience or by reading all of those Bend in the Bible Belt plays I made them read, I think they'd say, absolutely not.
Well, so our next and last guest is going to spin a yarn of Western intrigue. Please welcome all the way from Wyoming, Mac Woolley.
So my boss had just been promoted from Three Peaks Ranch to HQ on the other side of the mountains. The ranch was a part of the National Outdoor Leadership School, or NOLS, and our main purposes were to ride what we called re-rations of food and gear into the mountains to resupply backpacking trips, or we also welcomed groups of people from 16 to 70 plus years old, and we would teach them leadership skills and horse packing wilderness skills on these three-week courses in the mountains. Now, my boss, having been promoted, left a lot of work extra to do at the ranch, and I was assistant ranch manager at the time. And I was taking on a lot more of this responsibility and felt like I was in it all alone. The one thing I was really looking forward to that summer was getting to work this contract I've been wanting to work for the 4 years I'd been working at this ranch. It would include me as a solo horse packer with four horses being support for an adult hiking course. The three horses that we're packing would carry food and any non-essential gear just to make the loads a little lighter for these adults hiking out there. And we would go into the Wind River Range in Wyoming, and the winds are known for these like steep granite peaks and plentiful alpine lakes. And I'd been working really hard and was really looking forward to what I was calling a working vacation, where I would have short days of travel, get to camp early, get to jump in the lakes and read my book and maybe do some yoga and just really decompress, right? I was also really looking forward to this because I had been working all summer with this young Mustang named Lightning. And he was small and gray and had the softest pink nose with gentle eyes that were a little mousy and had this like little glimmer of mischief in them. And this was going to be Lightning's first time camping in the mountains, and my first time camping solo with horses. So, first day on the trail of this 10-day expedition, and I'm about 20 minutes in, and I'm riding Lightning, and I've got Oscar, Bear, and Roscoe behind me carrying gear. And it hits me. I'm doing it. I'm here. And the tears just start rolling, and I'm letting it go. And about 10 switchbacks up later, and maybe 20 minutes later, I'm still crying. But the feeling has shifted a little bit, and I am considering if I want to take the place of my boss, you know? Do I want to step into that more of a leadership role? And if I don't, I think I will move on from this place and this community that I love and feels like home. And so I'm grieving, right? Or potentially, who knows? Living in the future. Lightning brings me back to the present when he's like, dude, I've had enough of your crying. And he's like, I'm not going anywhere now with you, like this. And I'm like, okay, gotta get present here. I'm like, start, you know, clucking a little and kicking him a little bit and try to get him going, and he's not. And so I get a little bit bigger with my ask. I'm like clucking and kicking and clucking and kicking, and Lightning's not going, but the other horses are getting amped up. And so they start doing circles around us, and they clothesline Lightning, and he lands on my leg. And we both stand up. We shake it off. And we're okay. But that's when it hits me. This is not going to be a working vacation. This is going to be work. And I'm going to need a vacation at the end. So fast forward 3 days. And I am on a bench in the morning just above Rainbow Lake. And I'm packing up the panniers. And I'm almost done, but I take a look around and make sure the horses are nearby. They have their bells, they're jingling, and they're like happily swishing their tails and eating grass. I'm like, good, they seem happy. I'll finish packing my bags, and then I'll catch them. So pack up, 5, 10, 15 minutes later, I pop my head up, look around. I don't see the horses, and I listen. I don't hear them. I go and look in the woods all around camp, and I don't see them. I get to the edge of the bench, and I look over across Rainbow Lake, and they're at the far end, probably like a mile away, and they're heading back toward the camp that we came from the day before. So I grab two halters, and I don't know if you all know, horses are herd animals. They want to stay together, right? So I think two is plenty. The other two will follow. And I walk down the trail. I meet up with the horses. I catch two of them. Great. Start walking back to camp. And the other two don't follow. So I think, no problem. I just caught the wrong two. These two are not persuasive enough, and I'll catch the other two. So I catch the other two and start leading them back to camp. And Oscar and Lightning don't follow. So I think, okay, I'm going to tie these two up, and I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'll figure it out. And then I look over my shoulder, and Oscar and Lightning are heading with quite some pace back to the camp that we'd stayed at the day before. So I am hooked. I'm like heading after them in my cowboy boots, my jeans, and my pearl snap shirt. And I'm walking after them at a fast pace, but I don't want to run too fast. If I do, that'll push the horses even further. And they get out of sight. And a little ways later, I come across a group of backpackers, and they're in their nylon outfits with their giant backpacks. And one of them asks, oh, you know, I just saw a couple horses down the trail. Are those yours? And I say, oh, yes, thank you so much. And then in my head, I'm thinking, yes, of course they're mine. Look at me. And I keep going further. At this point, it's been hours since I have drinking or eaten anything, and I am very thirsty. I get to a creek, and I just wade right into it and scoop my hands into the water and drink from it. I don't even care that I might get Giardia. Those symptoms will come later. I keep going. I'm going up and down hills through the woods, and we get to the Sheep's Desert, which is this big open alpine meadow at about 10,000 feet in elevation. And I don't see the horses. And that's when my heart sinks. What if I don't find these horses? They could get hurt. They could die. Horses are so resilient, yet so fragile. If they break a leg, they're done. And I am responsible for this. I also realized at this point, I didn't bring my satellite phone with me. So truly, I am in this all by myself. I have no other resources. And I have no choice but to continue on. I cross the like 1 or 2 miles across the Sheep's Desert, and I get to South Fork Lake, where we had camped the night before. And I look around, and I see their tails swishing. And they're standing as if they're tied up to 2 trees right next to them. And I walk over to them, and I realize I don't have any more halters. So, luckily, Oscar had a bell around his neck. Lightning did not. So I pull my belt off, and I put it around his neck, and I grab a strap in each hand, and I start walking back toward Rainbow Lake. And we get most of the way across the Sheep's, back across the Sheep's Desert. But it's been challenging. The bugs are horrible, and these horses are going nuts. They're trying to rub the flies off on me as I'm walking, and it's feeling like it's like I might get hurt, like they might just run over me. And so I let go of Lightning, and as I do, I tell him, "Don't make me regret this." We walk another 100 feet, and he's following. And I'm thinking, okay, something is going my way today. And we walk another 100 feet, and I turn around, and Lightning is hightailing it back to South Fork Lake. So I get Oscar and Roscoe and Bear back to camp, and I take a moment. I feed myself. I drink. And I pick up the satellite phone. And there's a small piece of me that has shame. These horses, like I am, my job is to take care of them and also to make sure that the people that are on this course have food. I'm not going to be able to fulfill either of those duties right now. And another part of me knows I have done the best I could. So I pick up the phone, and I call the ranch. We come up with a plan, and I hang up. And I feel a sense of relief, knowing I'm no longer on this journey all by myself. I have a team, though not physically with me, there to support me. So the 3 horses and I head back to South Fork Lake with about a 30 minutes of daylight left. We look for Lightning. He's not there. The next day, I bring food to the course to make sure that they are good for a few days. I don't know how long it's going to take to find Lightning. And give them food, head back. It was about 4 days worth of travel in one day. And the next day, ranch staff, about 4 of them, come in to join me and help look for Lightning. We look up and down those mountains and don't find him. So I send them out that day, and when they get to the trailhead, there's Lightning tied to a tree, no belt around his neck. I'm a little disappointed. But he looks very, very tired. And when I call out on the sat phone that night, I hear this news, and I think to myself, man, I wonder what he was doing these last few days. Was he lonely? Was he scared? Did he learn his lesson? Probably not. The next day, I ride to meet up with the group, and the day after that, I finally get to jump in the lake and read my book, and do some yoga. A few days later, I ride out of the mountains without much more incident. And I get back to the ranch and realize that the ranch manager job has been posted. and it would entail managing 80-plus horses, 240 acres, several buildings, a fleet of 6-plus trucks and trailers, a staff of about 14 people, plus 20 instructors, and 200-plus students. And when I read that job description, I'm like, no way, have not gotten my vacation yet. That sounds like way too much work, right? But I take a moment, I walk out to the corral, I walk up to Lightning, put my arm around his neck, I rub his face, and I take a deep breath. And I realize what I've learned in the mountains on that expedition. And when faced with seemingly insurmountable problems or tasks, if I'm able to take a deep breath, slow down, and call my team for help, my team shows up for me, and it makes all the difference in the world. So I apply for the job, and I never do get my vacation because I got it and started 3 weeks later. And it was the hardest and the best job I've ever had. Thank you.
This has been an edited live recording of a Pivot Spokane main stage event that was captured on January 25th, 2024 at the Washington Cracker Building in downtown Spokane. The theme of the evening was firsts, and there were 6 storytellers in total at this event: Tyler Koopman, Brad Hauge, Amy Midstock, Jerry Newell, Michael Schneider, and Mackenzie Woolley. The MC for the evening was James D. Bean Johnston, and the interstitial music was provided by DJ Normo. For more details on this and future Pivot events, visit pivotspokane.com.